So good morning, Peter. Thank you very much for joining us. As
You're
we've
welcome.
discussed ahead of time, the theme of this interview is mostly to talk about the replica symmetry breaking period from 1975 to 1995. But to get to that, we have a few background question, if you don't mind. And in particular, we'd like to start with what led you to study physics and then to pursue a PhD in theoretical physics?
Oh, I think it was because I wasn't much good at anything else, actually. And I never was able to remember very much stuff. So something like foreign languages. So my apologies for my previous attempts to speak French will indicate that. And also history was too many things to remember. But physics, you don't have to remember so much. You have to understand very well some basic stuff and everything follows from that. And I've never been very, so why a theorist? Because I've never been very good with my hands. So I thought I would be better off doing theory than experiment.
And towards the end of your time at Oxford, you started being interested in the renormalization group, right? Like many people at that time. But how did you come to that? How did that come for you?
Right. Well, I actually spent a very long time in Oxford, and at this point, I was a postdoc. That's right. And it was clear that the renormalization group was something important, but it wasn't so simple for those who were outside that area to understand. So there were a series of sort of self-help lectures organized by one of the then faculty members there, Gillian Gehring. So she organized these, and I think different people would talk on a paper that they'd read to do with the renormalization group. So I got a bit familiar with it then, and then I realized that what the problem I'd been doing my thesis on, I had done my thesis on, which is the Ising model in a transverse field, and for which earlier work by my thesis advisor, Roger Elliott, and others had said just found sort of numerically from series expansions and stuff that the quantum transition was like the thermal transition between one higher dimension. And I realized that the renormalization group, you could see that very easily. So I wrote a little paper on that. And then actually I realized that a more detailed work along similar lines, but for a different topic, that is itinerant magnets, had been done by I'm thinking of Ferti, but no, it was not Ferti, by John Hertz, that's right.
And from that, you quickly realized that you could use real space RG to study the Edwards-Anderson model in finite D. Could you tell
Yes.
us a bit more how you first heard about this model and where this idea come?
You mean the Edwards-Anderson model?
Yes.
Again, I have a memory of it being one of these sort of self-help lectures that we also learned about the renormalization group. And I think in what maybe it was in that series or not in that series, but somebody gave a talk on this paper by Edwards and Anderson. And I remember that the replica part, which was presumably Edwards's part, seemed very mysterious. And there was actually another part which nobody talked about since then, but which was probably the bit of Anderson where he talked about dynamics and factoring dynamical correlations, which at the time seemed maybe more intuitive, but that never caught on. And it was the replica approach that definitely caught on.
So you just connected the two, the renormalization group that you had been working on and this model,
Right, yeah, so we were aware of from these self-help lectures, one of the ones was on the real space renormalization group with Niemeyer and van Leeuwen. And then it was not a big step to realize that for disordered systems, what you had to do was do a rescaling of the distribution of the interactions. That was in principle what you had to do. Now, maybe in practice, you had to make some approximations like considering a few moments, but in principle, what you had to do was a transformation of the distribution. So
I
this was
see.
about when I went as a postdoc to Oxford, to Grenoble, to the Institut Henri Langevin.
So were you in touch with David Sherrington at that point, who was also, who had been on your thesis committee, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yes, he was on the thesis committee. I would say at that point, I was not in touch with David Sherrington. That came a bit later when we were both at Imperial College. So okay. That started, I was at Imperial from 78 to 85. And during that time, David was also at Imperial College.
So in your contribution to the Roger Taliot face shrift, you wrote that that Roger had been a big influence in convincing you that disordered systems was a rich and challenging area. Was this early on in your study or later on in, how does these encouragements come?
This was when I was even a graduate student, Roger was working on disordered systems in electronic systems, things like the coherent potential approximation. So I guess I realized from him that it wasn't just dirt, that you had to, you know, try and understand enough to push it out of the way. There was new physics in the disorder, which one should try to understand. And I guess this came very much to fruition in the spinglass field, where a whole lot of new stuff appeared.
So he had not been specifically interested in spin glasses.
No, I don't think he ever worked on spin glasses.
So can I ask one question about, because you mentioned your stay in Grenoble.
Yes.
Can you tell us something about what was the, because we interviewed other people who mentioned Grenoble as a place where ideas were developed about disordered systems. So can you tell us a little bit what was the atmosphere in Grenoble, who was there, who you collaborated with, if you...
Yeah, so I was in Grenoble 75 to 77, and the head of the group was Nozier. So, I mean, I never wrote a paper with Nozier, but I felt he was always very supportive of my work. One of the people who was there was Byron Southern. He's now been in Winnipeg for many years. And so we developed a bit more the real space renormalization group for disorder systems like spinglasses. And curiously, about the person who replaced me in the ILL, and I think we overlapped for one day, was none other than Duncan Haldane, who went on there while he was still at Grenoble, I think, to develop the idea of the Haldane gap, as it is now called.
So Byron had been a postdoc with David Sherrington also before moving to the ILL. Was there a Sherrington connection there, or was that
I guess there was a Sherrington connection there, and that was maybe through Byron. I'm not really remembering exactly how these papers on spinglasses developed, but I can well imagine it was definitely through Byron and his influence from David Sherrington that we probably got started working on spinglasses together.
I see.
And I know that at the same time, Robin Stinchcombe in Oxford was working on spin glasses. Elliot was not, but Stinchcombe was. And it turned out we've been doing various things independently. So we decided to write up, I think it was the first paper I wrote on real space renormalization group for spin glasses was actually with Stinchcombe. And then I continued further with Byron Southern.
I see. So in 1979, early 1979, actually, you wrote a review about spin glasses in which you argue that based on the results of the RSB scheme of Bray and Moore, one should expect an infinite number of symmetry breakings in the ordered phase. What gave you that confidence? And did you actually anticipate the Parisi result?
I didn't anticipate the Parisi result. You've got me there, I have to admit. I don't really remember that. I know there was an early replica symmetry breaking idea of Bray and Moore, which seemed quite bizarre, but you did have the idea of dividing these replicas up into blocks. But what it didn't have was the infinite hierarchy that the Parisi scheme had. So I'm afraid I don't remember what motivated me to write that comment in that Could you tell me which review you're talking about? It was a summer school, is it, or something like that?
I have it here. I think so. It was a 1978 summer school, and these are the proceedings from that school where it was published. Actually, no, it was for the Conference on Magnetism and Magnetic Materials in Cleveland, Ohio. And then you wrote that review that published in early 1979 in Journal of Applied Physics.
I will have to go back. You're better aware of my work than I am, obviously. So, yeah, sorry, I don't know what induced me to make that comment, which seems prophetic, but certainly at the time, I had no idea that Parisi was going to come out with this amazing scheme.
So how did you find out then about the Parisi result, and what was your response or your reaction to it?
Well, I mean, it came out in bits and pieces, didn't it? I mean, there wasn't just one paper where it was all done, finished and polished. It came out in several papers, and I was just aware of the papers as they were coming out. And I thought the idea of this infinite hierarchy was very interesting. But I suppose, like everybody else, what it also actually meant physically was very mysterious. And it was only later that we understood how one could interpret these functions that were in the Parisi theory. And I mean, I suppose the crucial thing when you started to think, well, maybe this is right, was when he was doing his sequence of approximations. Of course, as you know, the full equations are extremely complicated and you can't really solve those analytically. But he had a sequence of approximations. The first of all was the replica symmetric theory of Sherrington-Kirkpatrick, and that gave this negative entropy. I mean, that was the smoking gun, the negative entropy. It was almost like a little afterthought in the Sherrington and Kirkpatrick paper, but that was actually the most important thing in it. The rest was pretty much redoing for Ising spins what Edwards Anderson had done for Heisenberg spins. And these sequence of approximations of Parisi, he found that at very low temperatures, the negative entropy diminished in magnitude. And it looked reasonably plausible that if you could extrapolate to an infinite hierarchy, that the entropy would go to zero and that would be satisfactory. So that really was what induced one, I think, to think, well, maybe this is the right answer.
I see. So shortly after the first couple of those papers, you start collaborating with Scott Kirkpatrick, right, on doing computer simulations of the SK model. And then also shortly after that, I think you had your first PhD student, Neil McKinsey, who did Monte Carlo simulations on the SK model. So what led you to this computational approach and down this path?
Well, I think the analytical approach with replicas seemed so strange that I thought maybe with some careful numerics, one could get a little bit of intuition. I guess Scott Kirkpatrick invited me to spend a month or so in the summer at Yorktown Heights, where he was then. And so we wrote a paper together on some numerics. So that was quite interesting because I'd been working at Imperial College developing a code to do, I forget, whatever aspect of spin glasses, and I wanted to take this code with me and run the code on all the big computers at Yorktown Heights. But this was well before the internet. So how do I actually take this code? So, of course, the professional way to do it would be magnetic tape in those days. So, but every tape system was different. There was no standardization, so that was felt to be likely to be difficult. So I went back to what even then was fairly old technology, and that was punch cards. So I got a whole bunch of punch cards printed out in England and took them on the plane with me. And then there was still a punch card reader at Yorktown House, and everybody gathered around to see it being used, and the cards were fed in, and then we could develop a bit the code there and run it. So that was a little historical aside.
So you had computational experience before then. How did that come about in your case?
Right. Well, perhaps I'm just trying to remember what. So when I was at Imperial College, that's right. That's, of course, in London, part of the University of London. And at that time, there was a British computer company called ICL, International Computers Limited, I think. And they had a really amazing parallel processor called distributed array processor. It consisted of a 64 by 64 array of small processors, very small, basically 1-bit processors, and which ran in parallel. And this was actually perfect for doing Ising spinglass simulations. And the lattice structure was there built into the hardware. So I got into simulating the Edwards, the two-dimensional, three-dimensional spinglasses using this distributed array processor. And I've always regretted that. I thought for these sort of Ising simulations, it was really a very nice, nice machine. But with a typical British business, the technology was very good, but the management and the marketing was very poor. So this just, it was never developed. It just faded away. But it was clear that numerics, right from the early days, this was very tough analytically, and numerics was going to have a pretty important role. So I thought I should get into this, particularly with Monte Carlo simulations.
So Imperial had bought one of those machines, or the company gave you access to their own?
No, there was one at another of the colleges of University of London, Queen Mary College.
Okay.
So I used it there. I used the one that was there.
I see. You also start to collaborate with Kurt Binder shortly thereafter, about the same time. And that led to your writing your magnum opus, in a sense, right? The Reviews of Modern Physics paper.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So I forget how these visits were arranged, but I was able to visit Kurt Binder in Mainz on at least a couple of occasions. I think one connection there was I had, well, at the beginning of my time in Santa Cruz, I had a postdoc called Joseph Rager, who then went back to Germany and worked with Kurt Binder. So then Binder invited me to come to Mainz and work with him. So now I recall that must have been after the review. So how did the review, what was the impetus for the review?
So Kurt mentioned that both he and you had been asked by RMP to write a review, and you decided to join forces.
Yeah, that rings a bell. I think that's right. Yes. Okay. And of course, join forces. Well, it was sort of the efficiency with which those forces were activated was quite different, because Kurt had written his part of the paper very quickly and efficiently. And then I just started in Santa Cruz, and he kept pushing me and pushing me, when are you going to do your bit, and when are you going to do your bit? And eventually it got done, and it was obviously a lot of work. And even in some sort of mundane aspects, you know, now when if you want to keep track of citations, it's really easy, because you using LaTeX, you just have a label for each of the citations. Then the software says, keeps track of it. But then when we didn't have that then, everything was typed up by hand. And so we were having to try to keep track of which was the paper Bray and Moore 1978A and Bray and Moore 1978B and so on. And this was a nightmare to keep track of all those references, which would have been more straightforward now. But yeah, so this has been cited quite a lot. I'm pleased by that. And of course, it's massively out of date, so but that's inevitable.
So at about the time the review came out, you started working more closely with Alan Bray and Mike Moore as well. So yeah. is that connection more obvious or immediate to you?
Well, not really. I mean, how did that happen? I mean, before I went to US, I've been studying in the UK and working as a postdoc in the UK and then at Imperial College. So I'd run into Mike Moore quite a lot, and we had these we had this common interest in spinglasses. So it was pretty natural that we might try to join forces from time to time. I don't remember exactly now how that happened. But that's right. We did. There were one or two papers with my mom.
But so you were pretty interested with the droplet model, I presume, at that time? That's where it emerged?
Well, that's right. Yes. Yeah. So how does one characterize, you know, the Spengler state, the droplet model, or replica symmetry breaking, or something else? And so let me try and recollect my thoughts here. I mean, Mike was always pretty skeptical, less so now, but pretty skeptical about the replica symmetry breaking. And the droplet model he felt was more useful. And I'm just trying to recall that the paper we did on replica symmetry breaking. Now, what did we do there? I should have gone through my publications first. But
I mean, you have a paper entitled "Lack of Self-Averaging in Spin Glasses," which I think might be the first one.
That's another one. That's right. Yes.
And then weighted averages of TAP solutions and Parisi's
cube. Yes, that's right. So, I mean, the lack of self-averaging, this was at about the same time as Mazar and et al. Came out with all the very elegant ultrametric structure of the Parisi solution. And so one part of that is that you don't have self-averaging for certain quantities. And I guess that little tiny bit of their big work, I'd sort of figured out independently that you didn't have self-averaging, and maybe this would help understand certain aspects of the Sherrington-Kirkpatrick models, some of the numerics. And yes, now thank you for that. Now I recall. And then there were some other difficulties about the comparing the TAP solutions with the results of numerics and doing full thermal averages. And within the TAP solution, the deviation of the order parameter from one at low temperatures went like the temperature squared, if I remember correctly, whereas the overall average went like the temperature. And if I remember correctly, the idea there was that when you were doing the Gibbs average, you weren't just taking a single of the TAP solutions, you had to do a thermal average of different TAP solutions, and then you could reconcile these different results.
I see. So in the middle of all this, you did move to UC Santa Cruz, right, in 1995. And I was just curious, 1985. Was there any spin glass connection to that move, or was this completely independent from?
No, there was no spin glass connection there. I thought that going to the States would be challenging. It would be good for my career. And I think that was. I also thought that Santa Cruz would be a good place to live and have children grow up. So where I grew up in England was Lancaster, which is a small town. And then I was spent the previous, before going to Santa Cruz, I was 7 years in London. And although I now very much like to go back to London and go to the theater and all that, at that time, living in London to me was not great, because on a poor lecturer's salary, you couldn't live in the center of London. You had to commute, and I hate commuting. And also with young children, you couldn't really take advantage of the cultural amenities that the city had. So Santa Cruz is a small town, similar in size to Lancaster, the town that I grew up in the north of England. And so, of course, because it's a small town, there is somewhat limited amenities there, but we're not far away from San Francisco, which is my favorite American city. So we could and did until COVID take advantage of all the cultural amenities of San Francisco, go to the symphony orchestra, the theater and the opera and so on. So it was a bit like having the best of both worlds. You had the advantages of a small town. So I would, for about 25 years, I would back to work, but we could take advantage of the big city when we wanted to.
I see. And shortly after arriving at Santa Cruz, you co-organized with John Hopfield a meeting at the ITP, right? Institute of Theoretical Physics. That's right.
Yes. I was invited to do that. And so that was interesting and challenging to try to see the connections between spin glasses and the burgeoning field of neural networks, which John Hopfield was very paramount in providing a sort of eyeing type model of a neural network, which sort of horrified the biologists at the time, as I understand it, because it clearly wasn't very realistic biology, but it provided a lot of useful insights. So that was quite stimulating to attend those meetings. There were people from a variety of fields, including people working on real neurons and so on. And I think the sort of statistical mechanics approach to neural networks seemed to me had this sort of heyday at about that time in the late 80s, and then it rather diminished. But neural networks have now come back again in a big way with artificial intelligence. And so I thought, to me, that's been quite interesting. And what it never seemed to quite pan out in 25 years ago. Why is it panning out now? And maybe it's just because of the size of the computers and the size of the databases. If you really beat it, it works. And those big computers and big data sets were not available around in the late 80s and 90s.
So despite organizing the workshop, you actually never jumped on the neural network bandwagon. Was there a clear divide or clear reason for that?
Well, I just lack of any good ideas on what to do. I felt you had just working on some abstract StatMet model. There were a lot of people doing that, and I didn't feel I could contribute in that area, and I wasn't sure it was very useful. But I didn't really have any sort of biology people I knew who could provide me with some sort of stimulation with experiments. And why don't you explain these results and so on? So I never jumped on that wagon. That's right.
And at that point, you embarked also on a long-term collaboration with Ravin Bhat from Princeton on the simulation and finite size scaling analysis of spinning glasses. So more.
Right. Well, that had actually started earlier when I was at Imperial College, and Ravin had a sabbatical from Bell Labs. He was at Bell Labs then, and he spent several months at Imperial, and we started working together. And he actually came with some very interesting problems, which I didn't understand, about antiferromagnetic spin chains. And this is something, a field which afterwards developed very, very much with the work of people, these local singlet states and stuff like that. But at the time, I didn't understand any of that, and we never worked on that. So we started working on Monte Carlo simulations of spin glasses, like 3D spin glasses. And it was clear that what we wanted was a better way of doing finite size scaling than being done at that time, to try to locate more convincingly whether or not there was a phase transition in the three-dimensional Ising spin glass. And so the idea is that rather than try to fit at the same time the transition temperature and the critical exponents, you try to determine them one at a time. And one way of doing that is find some sort of dimensionless quantity, and the data for different sizes then intersect at the critical temperature if you neglect corrections to scaling. So I thought about trying various ratios of moments of the Edwards Anderson order parameter Q. So because you can have there's a trace Q cubed, which is not zero in Spin glass. I tried computing the ratio of the average of Q cubes suitably defined divided by the 3/2 power of the average of Q squared. And that the data for that didn't really intersect. It sort of came together and merged. And then I saw there was a paper by Binder doing for the ferromagnet, calculating the 4th power of the magnetization divided by the square of the 2nd power. And I thought, oh, well, that's the same idea, and that's sort of more familiar, so we'll do that for the spin glass, the 4th power of Q divided by the square of the 2nd power of Q, and that's what got published, and that's what people have done since then. But actually, the results at that time were very similar. The data merged as you lowered the temperature, but didn't splay out as you increased the size below the temperature, the transition temperature. So that was while I was still in Imperial College. And then we continued a little bit more work on that after I went to Santa Cruz.
So did Revan know anything about spinning glasses before he came to that visit, or did you introduce him to that?
I'm sure he knew something about it. He'd not worked on it before, so okay. I introduced him to spinning glasses. Yes, that's my recollection.
I see. So you were doing simulations at that time, and that's also when specialized computer architecture start to appear for simulate spinning glasses, right? Ogielski and the Ogielski's machine at Bell Labs. Were you concerned that you didn't have access to those machines to keep on competing, or how did you face that problem?
I felt that the special machines definitely had a place to play. Certainly at that point, the computer hardware was developing extremely fast. And if somebody spent maybe 2 years developing a specially dedicated computer, the design at the beginning would have been much faster than what you could get from a cluster of workstations. But by the time the special purpose computer was built, it wasn't obviously that much superior. And so I felt it was still true that one could do interesting work with a bunch of workstations. And that's still true. Of course, these special dedicated computers are very much continuing. There's this huge machine of the Rome and Zaragoza group led by Parisi, which does monumental calculations that would not be feasible, I think, for anybody else. So I would say right now, there are things that they can do that I don't think anybody else could do, because this machine is just so awesome and powerful.
So they have beaten Moore's law in that sense.
I guess so, yes.
So you've maintained a study of spin glasses funded through NSF throughout all this time, essentially without interruption. Was that ever a challenge? I mean, how receptive was NSF to supporting research on spin glasses?
Well, I think it was becoming increasingly not very receptive to doing it. So there were other things that I was working on. In particular, I would go into the quantum world and do disordered quantum phase transitions. So that was something of a new development. And I think the NSF was more amenable to that than just common or traditional spin glasses. And I would say and in addition, I was doing in the not so distant past, doing quantum annealing. So also going into quantum land, but a different area, trying to see by doing simulations on a classical computer, how efficient might be a quantum annealer of the sort made by the company D-Wave. So that that looked better. I also got some funding from the Army Research Office for that work. But I should say funding from the NSF was not easy. And there was definitely one major hiccup when for some reason they were only able to get three reviewers. Normally they get five or six, I would say. And they all gave it a rating of excellent, and the proposal was turned down. So I was quite unhappy about that. And in the US, this is fairly serious because the students need the support to live. And very much at the last minute, this funding was turned off. The program director said, well, although they said excellent, when you actually look at what they read, it wasn't as good as that. But I think this was definitely a part of the fact that the NSF wasn't that interested in funding spin glasses. And although there were quite a lot of other stuff in the proposal, in addition to spin glasses, there was also a spin glass side.
Can you situate us a bit in time? When would that have happened, or the wind started to change in this direction?
Well, I think it changed quite a long time ago. Let's see. It also, I think, depends a bit on the program manager. The program manager changed after about 10 years at my being in the US. And then I felt he was very supportive. And then the new program manager, Daryl Hess, I found was less supportive. And so that would have been in the early 2000s.
I see.
Yeah, about 2000, probably.
So you've kept on working on spin glasses for decades, right? And other things as well. But the question is, how did you become so enamored with it, right? How do you keep motivation to hit on this problem?
Right. Well, I think that, you know, at times there seems to be not much one can do, and that's a good time to work on other stuff. And then so some new development and some new ideas. So, and for example, the big question as to whether the replica symmetry breaking is applicable in real short-range spin glasses, for example, in three dimensions, this is still unresolved, but a characteristic feature of the replica symmetry breaking is this De Almeida-Thouless line of transitions in a magnetic field. So then I realized, well, actually, one could quite straightforwardly, at least in principle, Monte Carlo that. Put it, there's a quantity which is like a susceptibility, which is actually what Almeida and Thouless calculated, and the sort of spin glass susceptibility in a magnetic field. And you could calculate this in a standard way using Monte Carlo simulations to avoid systematic effects. You need four copies because you have products of four thermal averages, but this you can do. And you can also, as I mentioned earlier, you would like dimensionless quantities to do the finite size scaling. And you can also find a dimensionless quantity, sort of a correlation length. You divide that by the system size. You can do nice finite size scaling. So I put quite a bit of effort into doing this. And for what it's worth, those simulations seem to indicate that in high dimensions, it looked like you did have an Almeida-Thouless line, and probably not in low dimensions. So from time to time, there's some new idea comes up, and then one has another push at it. Right now, as you know, I'm retired and I'm not really giving a hard push on anything, but I certainly think even if I wasn't retired, I wouldn't be spending a huge amount of time on spin glasses. I at least don't have any particular idea on how to solve these major problems of the nature of the spin glass state. And certainly I can't compete with the numerics that the Rome Zaragoza group can do. So I'm right now not really doing spin glasses, do a little bit on quantum computing, and that's about it.
You were never interested in the structural glass problem.
Well, that's not quite true. It's one thing to be interested in, it's the other thing to figure out how one can make a contribution. So I read around quite a bit and learned about the Kautzmann paradox and all this sort of stuff. And it seemed to be really quite mysterious. And I did think a bit about the question of whether, if you could wait an infinite amount of time, whether there would be an ideal glass transition. if you really could wait an infinite amount of time, because you never actually get there. And there were some papers of Mike Moore, which I thought were quite interesting. He was arguing that maybe the structural glass is a bit analogous to a spin glass, but in a magnetic field. Of course, there's no quench disorder in a structural glass. Somehow the system makes its own disorder. But in a magnetic field, in the spin glass, you don't have a sort of up-down symmetry. It's quite strange that you have a phase transition, but there's no symmetry change. You don't have up-down symmetry. Now, if you think of a structural glass, you have density fluctuations which get frozen in. And there's no symmetry of those density fluctuations about the average density. Increasing the density by a bit is not exactly equivalent to decreasing the density by a bit. So maybe there's some rough connection there between a putative ideal glass transition and the Dalmater Thallus line, the transition in a magnetic field. And if, as Mike Moore argues, there is no Almeida Thallus line in three dimensions, then there, strictly speaking, would not be an ideal glass transition in three dimensions. So, yeah.
So from your career, having bridged both sides of the Atlantic, do you have any insight on the difference in interest in replica symmetry breaking ideas in the US and in Europe?
Well, the ideas, of course, originated in Europe, and I think that's where the main interest has carried on. Of course, Giorgio has a big group, and he continues to be very active. And there's a big group in Spain, Victor Matamayor and others, and also people like Mike Moore in England. I would say that there's not very, very much activity in the US. I think the activity there is tend to be of a more mathematical nature. And I'm thinking of the work of Newman and Stein. And so they approach things from a more mathematical nature. And I have to confess, I've always found their work hard to follow. I think there's a difference of vocabulary and between what they're talking about when they talk about a state and when I talk about a state, maybe we don't mean exactly the same thing. And this has caused a certain amount of confusion. And I mean, reading their papers, they seemed in the past to be saying, well, they were pretty confident that RSB in some format could not exist in short range spin glasses. And now I think they've rather backed off that. And this is in particular has been looked at again recently by Nick Reed. And he has a picture with in which it's perfectly feasible to have for short range spin glasses a replica symmetric solution suitably defined for a short range system. So basically, I would say there's not been all that much interest in replica symmetry breaking in the US. I mean, for example, most of the simulation work is, at least in decades, has been in Europe.
So you think it's mostly a center of gravity issue between the two continents in terms of the people who were trained?
Yes, the center of gravity is certainly in Europe, and lots of people were trained in that area. And I should, of course, have mentioned the Paris School and people like Mézard and people around him have been very important in this area.
So during your... Oh, sorry, Francesco.
Yeah, I wanted to ask another question of similar nature. So there is this fact that the community working on this on classical disordered systems and on quantum disordered systems are quite disconnected. And I think you are one of the few persons who explored both sides, the quantum and the classical. So do you understand why there is some difficulty to share ideas between the two communities? And did you try to export ideas from classical spin glasses to the quantum world? And do you feel that it's something interesting and that you succeeded in doing that?
Well, I certainly tried to have a foot in both camps and whether I succeeded in interesting the quantum people in this in to more traditional spin glass aspects. I guess I don't really know. I think that if you go to the quantum case, even if you don't have frustration, but you have disorder and quantum mechanics, there's a lot of interesting physics which people wanted to sort out. And that's not true to quite the same extent in classical disordered, say, Ising model. For example, the Griffith's singularities are extremely important in the quantum case, and they can give you big measurable effects even in the paramagnetic phase at low temperatures. And although in principle Griffith's singularities exist in classical magnets above the transition temperature, their effects are extremely weak. You get some sort of thing like an essential singularity, which is not measurable in experiments or simulations. And the additional effects of frustration, at least in some cases, are argued to not make all that difference. For example, for the one-dimensional transverse field Ising model with disorder, Daniel Fisher has this very beautiful theory with the infinite random fixed point, where when you rescale the distribution doing some sort of real space renormalization group, the distributions of the random transverse field and the random interactions get broader and broader. And so things that you can figure out what's going on by tracing out in perturbation theory the largest term in the Hamiltonian. So if you have that situation where just say the largest interaction dominates, then it's argued that frustration is not playing a very much of an additional role. So I think this is one of the reasons why spin glass is not taken into the quantum community so much. Though in the fairly new field of many body localization, I've seen work where the different phases one can have are related to spin glasses. And so I think there is some interest there. In fact, particularly one of the people who is very important in many body localization is David Hughes. And he has, of course, has done a lot of old portent work in the past on spin glasses with Daniel Fisher and the major proponents of the droplet picture. So there's definitely some intuition in spin glasses being taken over to an important quantum problem, many body localization.
And what about quantum computing? So you have worked a lot recently on that.
Well,
that's a place where in principle, spin glass ideas about, slowing down, dynamical slowing down and barriers, and non-trivial structures of phase space could play a role.
Right. So, because quantum computing means different things to different people. I mean, there's the traditional gate or circuit model of quantum computing, for which the famous algorithm is that of Shor for factoring integers. And this uses quantum parallelism to try to get you a quantum speed up. And quantum parallelism is extremely susceptible to a slightest bit of decoherence from the external noise, which inevitably is there. So the area that I was working on, and I got interested in this by invited to go to a conference on the topic in Florida, Key West, and that was quantum annealing. So there you try to it may be inspired by Scott Kirkpatrick and Cohen thermal annealing or simulated annealing to try to use quantum fluctuations to see if you could find the optimal solution to an optimization problem. And So I regard this as a sort of example of a sort of quantum simulator. The device is actually simulating a particular Hamiltonian, and the Hamiltonian is the classical optimization problem plus something like a transverse field which induces transverse fluctuations. And on the one hand, there's no obvious reason like quantum parallelism why you would not naturally expect a quantum speed up. On the other hand, there might be, and you hope, and it's probably true, that you're not quite as sensitive to external noise. So with these sort of quantum simulators, of which quantum annealers, I would say, are one type, you have a better chance of building a device in the near or intermediate term. And indeed, in particular, the efforts of the D-Wave have built a device with several thousand qubits. And they do not claim that these qubits are coherent, maintain phase coherence during the time of the simulation, but they still claim that you can get some fine ground states efficiently, and whether it's more efficient or not than simulated annealing or some other classical method, this is not clear. But so yes, that's right. So the optimization problems are very much similar to spin glasses. In fact, finding a ground state of a spin glass is an optimization problem. And many of the toy models that the people study are related to spin glasses. So definitely the spin glass ideas have been involved in this area of quantum annealing, which I, as I say, worked on for a while, but I haven't actually been working really on that recently.
During your time at Imperial and later at Santa Cruz, did you ever get to teach about replica symmetry breaking and spinning glasses? And if you did, could you give us a bit of details?
No, I don't. I mean, when I was teaching, it was the sort of the mainstream physics classes. Actually, curiously, in Imperial College, I was in the maths department. They had a mathematical physics group, and who surprisingly were not at all the sort of heavy duty mathematical physics types. They were more phenomenological people like me and David Edwards, who was working on itinerant magnets and so on. And so I was taking a lot of classes of math for engineers, and I did some graduate classes but that was statistical mechanics, solid state physics, that sort of thing. So I did not give a course on spin glasses or anything like that. As you already noted, I did give some talks, sort of review talks at conferences, you mentioned one, and also a number of schools have given brief summaries of spin glass work, but I've never given a course on spin glasses as such.
Or included notions of replica symmetry breaking in your STATMIC classes, for instance.
I did not include replica symmetry breaking in the STATMIC class. They were at a more elementary level than that, Ising for a magnet sort of level.
Yeah. Is there anything else that we may have skipped over that you think was important from that epoch, from that era?
Well, I mean, as we mentioned earlier, at first, this Parisi scheme seems so mysterious. This function Q of X, what is it? What is this function? And so, I mean, I have a little bit of a story about that. And I spent some time also visiting Cyrano de Dominicis in Saclay. And so, while I was there, also Parisi came. And so, I remember we were talking, and we had some discussions about if you take the spin in the SK model, the spin-spin correlation function squared, how is this related to Parisi's function? I said, well, it's the integral of Q squared and so on. And some higher order correlation, it's the integral of Q to the fourth and so on. And so, and I think Parisi wasn't sure about what I was saying. But what I should have done, if I'd understood what all the moments are, then I know what the distribution is. And somehow for me, the penny did not click. that all I was saying was that the distribution is dx by dq. And so when I went back to Imperial College, then finally the penny did click and Giorgio went back to Rome and immediately wrote a paper with that and sent it to David Sherrington. So I felt, from a personal point of view, I should have been more on the ball and I could have got credit for figuring out the physical significance of the Parisi result. But I just missed that last step, which Giorgio beat me to. But it's not a shame to be beaten by Giorgio, so I can live with it.
There's worse things, absolutely.
Yes.
So the last question is, do you still have notes, papers, correspondence from that epoch? And if yes, do you intend to deposit them in an academic archive at some point?
Well, deposit them in an academic archive, I'd never thought about that. And I don't think I have all that much old correspondence. I mean, there's and emails, some old emails I have, but I'm not sure how far they go back. So I don't think I would really want to go back and rummage through old emails and stuff like that
to figure it out. Well, if ever you find the time or the energy, I'd strongly encourage you to contact maybe UC Santa Cruz first to let their rare manuscripts and books might have.
Nothing rare about that. So in fact, related to that, may I ask where the results of all your detailed endeavors are going to appear?
Sure. So we'll just stop the interview and then we can chat about that. Is that okay? Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thanks for all those interesting questions.